support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. In the 1970s, Washington shut down Northern State, one of three psychiatric hospitals in the state. The move was part of a plan to deinstitutionalize our mental health system. Instead of treating people out of sight in central facilities, care would be provided at clinics within the communities people already lived in. At least, that was the plan. But the resources to effectively care for people in local communities never really materialized. And that's one of the frustrating conundrums we hear about in the newest episode of Lost Patients. It's a podcast from KUOW and the Seattle Times. Throughout the show, host Will James sets out to explore why so many people with severe mental illness go untreated in Washington State. Reporter Sydney Brownstone joins him on the journey. She describes her own reporting on Northern State, as well as her search for the hospital's lost patients, people who were released when Northern State was shut down. Since the podcast taped, Sydney has become an investigative reporter at the Seattle Times, moving off the paper's Project Homeless team. And I wanted to check in with her about how this research and the show has changed her perspective on homelessness in Washington and what she's learned from her search for Northern State Hospital's lost patients. Sydney Brownstone, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Sydney, your most recent episode of Lost Patients is about the process of deinstitutionalization, and that is happening in the 60s and 70s. It eventually leads to Northern State Hospital being closed in 73. For folks who don't remember that time, weren't around then, can you define what deinstitutionalization was for us?
Deinstitutionalization was the process beginning in the early 60s of taking people out of state-funded and state-run institutions and into so-called community care. It began with largely the 1963 Community Mental Health Act from JFK, and it continued into the 70s, 80s, and some would say even into today. The thing about deinstitutionalization is that I spent, you know, a few years as a homelessness reporter, and a lot of people point to deinstitutionalization and say, oh, that's the reason we have our homelessness crisis on the streets today. But through the process of reporting this story, we discovered that it was actually much more complicated than that.
I just want to lean into the arguments for deinstitutionalization for a moment. I mean, isn't there an argument that says centralized models aren't the best for people? What they need is to be near their families, in their communities, as opposed to kind of being a part of this big system that maybe is a more faceless way of receiving care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that people were subjected to horrors and human rights violations in the institutions. No doubt about that. On the flip side, what we've seen after the institutional era ended is a lot of pain and neglect. And that, you know, that kind of dichotomy has pushed a lot of people to feel a certain kind of nostalgia for these institutions, which is kind of an easy feeling to understand. But if we are real students of history, that's not quite what happened. And of course, the idea of community care was much, much preferable to people being locked away in these institutions. The issue is that community care never really came into existence. And what we did as a society is we got rid of the institutions. Okay, good progress. And then we made the world outside the institutions even less hospitable to people with serious mental illnesses and basically made it impossible to survive.
Yeah, the idea of deinstitutionalization didn't reflect the reality of what actually happened. There were these big promises about community mental health centers. What actually happened with that? I mean, what options for severely mentally ill people actually emerged from deinstitutionalization?
Well, community mental health centers never fully got funded. So, you know, states were really enthralled with the idea of community mental health centers. One, because it was part of this national movement. It really wasn't politically palatable to be keeping people in these institutions anymore. But also, number two, they could get out from under the responsibility of having to care for people with serious mental illness. And most importantly, out from under the cost of trying to care for people with serious mental illness. So once you introduce that kind of cost savings motive, that extends to all other areas of the mental health care system. And what we found is that, you know, not enough federal and local funding and, you know, frankly, community approval supported the existence of these community mental health centers. And at the same time that these community mental health centers kind of never really fully got stood up, we see the collapse of so many other support systems that could keep people afloat. So we see the kind of mass extinction of affordable housing through, one, you know, regulating away SROs, single-room occupancy units and group homes, but also just the affordable housing crisis and a severe lack of housing. We also see the rise of mass incarceration, and we see social services getting slashed left and right. So it's this convergence of all of these things working in tandem to push the most vulnerable people who in one point in time could survive either in the institution or living a marginal existence outside of the institution. It pushes them out onto the streets where they face conditions that may trigger psychosis.
Yeah, and I think that idea of responsibility, you and Will James, the host of Lost Patients, really explore that in the episode. It's like, okay, the states were on board with cutting costs and closing these large mental health institutions down, but then the local and federal funding didn't materialize. The federal government said, oh yeah, we're going to fund this. Whoops, nope, we're not. We're going to save money in the transition between Carter and Reagan. And then you just had people who are out in emergency rooms, who are on the street in you know, various stages of maybe their families are caring for them, maybe they're not. And you're covering the consequences of all that policymaking today, Sydney. I mean, you know, you have been a homelessness reporter at the Seattle Times. Now you're moving on to investigations. This idea that you are seeing a lot of the echoes of what was occurring because of deinstitutionalization is really brought home in this scene from Lost Patients. When you're looking at the archives of the Seattle Times and you're looking through stories from the 1980s, and I want to play a clip of kind of your reaction to what you found.
It froze me. A lot of things were flooding my brain at once, like, holy shit, the exact same thing is happening now. People are bouncing from the Morrison to the downtown King County Jail to Western and back again. We've been stuck in the same calcified loop for 40 years. And it's also like, what is even the point of my job then? If I keep writing the exact same sentences that someone 40 years ago was writing, why do I exist? Why are we doing any of this? Because clearly presenting people with the same information over and over and over again isn't doing anything. It's like we have made a decision as a society to not care about this, or that we are okay with this. And then what does that say about us? That we have been reading these same stories in our newspapers in every American city for 40 years, and we've decided that that is okay.
Sydney, can you tell me more about what led you to have that reaction in that moment? Like, what were you reading in the archives that really triggered that for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that no one really goes into journalism because they're like, this is a safe and stable and prosperous career. I mean, maybe some people do, but they're...
I don't know those people.
I don't know those people. The reason why we do this is because we care. And at the most base level, we care that bearing witness to what is happening today and presenting that information to the public will lead to a more informed public that will create better conditions for everyone. And I think there's a kind of moral injury that one faces when you've been reporting on a subject for a really long time, or maybe just a few years, and nothing changes. That was something that I was already familiar with. But to see in the archives that I had been typing literally the same sentences as someone put into their typewriter at the Seattle Daily Times 40 years ago was a whole nother level of what is going on. And I think it was an emotional reaction, but it also was a helpful reframing, because I think there's a temptation to look at current events and the conditions of our cities and, you know, the struggles people face in the mental health care system and the struggles with homelessness and be like, wow, this is something that's never happened before. Who could have anticipated this? And really, what we're seeing is a policy choice. It's not just one choice. It's choices that were made 20, 30, 40 years ago and that we continue to make today. And so shifting it from a passive, oh, I guess this is just happening and who knows why, and let's investigate the root causes, can feel futile when you realize that we know what the root causes are. And we as a society have chosen that we will take this in exchange for certain other conditions of living in America today.
I want to bring this home just with an individual story, and that's the story of Phil Dyro.
He talked continually. He just went on and on and on. And how he managed to cram so much information into that head of his, and where he got it, we do not know. But you could walk on the grounds, and I swear he knew what your name was, who you were married to, how many kids you had, no matter what, where you lived. He just had this appetite for knowledge about each individual employee. It was just amazing.
You kind of use Phil's story as an example of what happened to people after the big hospitals like Northern State closed. Who was Phil? What kind of a person was he? And why was he the example that you chose to tell?
So Phil was hospitalized at Northern State when he was a teenager and lobotomized not long after. He was hospitalized because he liked to talk. I don't know if he ever received a formal diagnosis for what we would consider serious mental illness, but he had this tendency to just go up to people and ask them a million questions, and he wouldn't stop talking. So it was odd behavior, you know, it was not normal behavior. But I think, you know, we can probably classify it as harmless. But as a result of being lobotomized, he struggled with seizures and other physiological issues for the rest of his life. And he wrote to attorneys while he was incarcerated at Northern State for 40 years and said, listen, I need to get out of this place. I don't need to be here. And he was right. He was let out of the hospital in 1971. And he continued his life on the outside, where he remained the same kind of guy. He had a lot of questions. He could really carry on and ask people a lot of questions about their personal lives. And the reason why I wanted to tell his story is because he was a really good narrative of what life could have been like inside the institution and some of the brutal treatments that people face, and also the hardship of trying to survive outside the institution.
Because Phil's life was tough when he got out of the hospital.
Yeah, he led a very marginal existence. He lived in a place called the Heartbreak Hotel, which I think existed on Harbor Island, I'm not quite sure. But he lived in these kind of group homes on Skid Row, in SROs, trying to make it with, you know, his disability payments, which were often barely enough to cover his expenses. And a social worker tried to help him. He kind of created a community for himself among kind of the misfits of downtown Seattle. And after he died, a bronze leaf with his name was placed in front of the Downtown Emergency Services Center, just kind of a testament to the role in society he found himself in later in life, kind of on the streets and living a very kind of meager existence.
It's really striking that he was kind of a poster child for deinstitutionalization in Washington State. Like, he was an example that policymakers looked at and said, this is a person who should not be locked away in a hospital. And yet, we failed as a society to build the safety net that was necessary for Phil when he got out. I mean, am I accurately assessing that?
I think that's true. But what's interesting is that I also look at Phil's story as even like, I mean, he had housing when he came out of the institution. That's not something that even exists anymore. There aren't many heartbreak hotels or SROs or, you know, cheap places, flop houses by the waterfront that you can crash in for however long you need. I mean, Phil's story is also representative of a time where you could still kind of find that. And that's almost wholly evaporated now.
Sydney, deinstitutionalization started with these big ideas. It's more humane to have people cared for closer to home, not locked away. And in many ways, it came from a place of love. I mean, even the president of the United States had a personal connection to this issue. How was JFK connected to this issue of mental illness and institutionalization? Just remind us of that.
So JFK's sister, Rosemary, was lobotomized when she was very young, and as a result, was in and out of institutions for the rest of her life. So JFK having a personal connection to this, but also having a public connection to this, was kind of revolutionary, because in the past, having a relative who was institutionalized was this huge, huge stigma. It connected to this idea that, you know, your family line was somehow degenerate or something like that. So for JFK to come out and say, listen, this happened to my sister and I want it to be better for people like her, was a really big deal.
If we had this big national conversation led by the president of the United States at the time about how to care for mentally ill people in a more humane way, and this was in the 60s that we were having this conversation, has there ever been a counterbalancing conversation since to reckon with how we engaged in deinstitutionalization and the ways that society failed to fulfill its promises? I mean, has that conversation ever truly happened at a national scale?
I mean, I think we see a version of this conversation unfolding in almost every major American city. And it usually goes something like this. You have family members of people with serious mental illness and certain psychiatrists and public figures saying, we have gone too far in the other direction. We have not created enough institutional support, or what they call beds, for people with serious mental illness, and we need to expand access to involuntary treatment. And then on the other side, you have oftentimes patient rights advocates or former patients themselves, people with serious mental illnesses, you know, public figures and some psychiatrists saying, absolutely not, we cannot return to the horrors of the past. And I think what this framing of the debate often misses is that there's a lot these two different sides can agree on. And it also focuses in almost exclusively on our crisis care system. And if you're only looking at involuntary treatment, if you're only looking at the availability of inpatient beds, you are missing the whole spectrum of care that is so necessary to prevent people from getting that sick in the first place. And that is the key piece of what we are so often missing.
And I really want people to listen to episode 4 of Lost Patients. You and Will James actually sit down with Washington State Governor, the former governor, Dan Evans, at his home. And he reflects on this process of closing Northern State Hospital and deinstitutionalization overall and the issue of responsibility. Evans was 97 years old at the time that you spoke with him, and fairly sharp in his recollections of the challenges, the political challenges of dealing with mental illness as a state government. And folks should really check that out and kind of hear from him and his what he remembers at that time. Sydney, right now, King County is looking at standing up these crisis care centers that were funded by a levy that voters passed. The property tax in that levy is expected to fund 5 24/7 walk-in crisis centers over the next 7 years. Is this an example, finally, of the local municipalities actually stepping up and fulfilling those promised community care centers that happened that never appeared after deinstitutionalization?
Yeah, it's definitely a step, right? I think it's probably a step in the right direction. There are bigger problems too, like the lack of a mental health workforce and the incentives that exist for people to work in that field, or just the payment structure of how we pay for this care.
Sydney, having covered now mental illness and also unhoused issues for a long time at the Times, do you think anything today is changing? Like, do you see political will, maybe public awareness changing around the kind of resources that are actually needed to tackle these extremely challenging and layered problems like mental illness and homelessness?
I hope so. I mean, I think these issues have definitely gotten way more attention in recent years, and that can be a double-edged sword because, you know, attention is good, but misinformation is widespread. I think the thing to emphasize is that while people may be paying much more attention to these things now because they're so, so visible and a part of often daily life for any resident of a city, these situations that we see in our cities are the result of policy choices made decades ago and that we continue to make to this day. So if you want to do something about it, look at our policies and choose different ones.
Sydney Brownstone is an investigative reporter with the Seattle Times, and she is a reporter on the podcast Lost Patients, which is a co-production of the Seattle Times and KUOW. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. I am really enjoying the show, Sydney, and thank you so much for all your work.
Thank you, Libby.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.